Thank you very much, Rick. And it's really an honor for me to be standing before you. It's a vast crowd and an exciting day. I was here last night also and had the privilege of observing what happened as God moved in such a gentle and yet such a persuasive manner. When you look at a crowd like this, it is very easy for you to lose the reality of the fact that God wants to speak to you as an individual. Every time Jesus spoke to a crowd, he looked at it as a multiplied opportunity for individual conquest. Let me repeat that. Every time Jesus spoke to a crowd, he looked at it as a multiplied opportunity for individual conquest. And his desire today is to get that victory over your life in you and then through you. My subject this morning is the theme announced, the disciplines of a godly man. Many of you may be familiar with the well-known writer and novelist Jack Higgins. One of his best-known books years ago was entitled, The Eagle Has Landed. Somebody was interviewing Jack Higgins and asked him this question. What is it that you now know that you wished you had known when you were a young man? What is it that you now know that you wished you had known when you were a young man? Jack Higgins did not have to think long and hard. He answered immediately and he said this, I wish somebody had told me then that when you get to the top, there's nothing there. I wish somebody had told me then that when you get to the top, there's nothing there. The Oxford scholar Alistair McGrath, in one of his books, refers to the well-known German tennis player Boris Becker. And he mentions this comment that Becker mentioned in one of his interviews. After he had won the second time the Wimbledon title for himself, Becker said to the press reporter, my greatest struggle in my life is still this battle with suicide. Can you imagine a man who had conquered his field of expertise uttering the fact that one of his greatest struggles was the struggle with suicide? A few weeks ago, one of the Dallas Cowboys, one of the well-known players on the Dallas Cowboys team, was being interviewed by a press reporter. And that reporter was in my office and told me this story. He said, I looked at him in the eye and I said to him, something has happened to you in recent times. What is it? And the man looked at the reporter and said, I have committed my life to Jesus Christ. The reporter looked at him and he said to him, when did this happen? And the man said very clearly, he said, I can tell you exactly when it happened. It was the night we won the Super Bowl a couple of years ago. I went back home and I lay in bed that night and I thought to myself, I have won every coveted award I ever set for myself, and yet I am lonelier and emptier than ever. I knew I needed something more than a Super Bowl ring. I knew I needed God. Now tell me, think for a moment, the loneliest moment in life. Now I want you to hear me clearly. The loneliest moment in life is when you have just experienced that which you thought would be the ultimate pleasure and it has let you down. The loneliest moment in life is when you have experienced that which you thought would be the ultimate pleasure for you and it has let you down. But gentlemen, isn't it true of your life, as it is true of mine, that we go through day after day, month after month, year after year, sometimes thinking there's some experience out there, some book that I can write, some exuberant moment that I can enjoy, some delightful emotional experience, and yet we go through those, and one after another, they let us down. So the question arises in this fashion. Is it possible to be a totally fulfilled man or a woman? Is it possible to be a totally fulfilled human being without violating the laws of God, without crossing the boundary lines that he has set as the blueprint for your life and mine? Is it possible to be a totally fulfilled man without violating the law of God and going away from the blueprint that God has set for your life? And if so, what does that kind of a man look like? I have selected for my character study this morning the Old Testament prophet by the name of Daniel. And I want to look into his life and draw some principles that will enable you to draw the lines in the right places so that you can be a disciplined man in whom and through whom God does his work. May I read the word of God to you in the first chapter of the book of Daniel. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hands, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put in the treasure house of his God. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring in some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility. Young men, without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and the literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that they were to enter the king's service. Among those were some from Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief official gave them new names, to Daniel the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself this way. We stop right there in the story, and we begin to see the principles that Daniel espoused, and by the end of the chapter you will see how the king recognized that there was something extraordinary about this young man. Gentlemen, let us go back to the historical backdrop in which you see this man called Daniel. Listen to me carefully, please. I'm going to move along some very important thoughts, and you're going to have to just move along this track with me to understand both the text and the context. About 1,000 years before Daniel had come on the scene, God had delivered the nation of Israel from bondage in Egypt into the promised land. That journey could have been a very short journey, a maximum time of 4 to 6 weeks. But God took them through that wilderness experience that lasted 40 years. In our time, that would be considered 2 generations. For 40 years, they wandered rather than take a 5 to 6 week short journey. And God tells them why he had them take that protracted route. The reason was this. He wanted to teach them 3 of the most important lessons in life. Number 1, humility. He said, I wanted you to be able to look into your own heart and see your heart as I see it. Number 2, he said, I wanted to teach you spirituality, that man would not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeded from the mouth of God. And thirdly, he said, I wanted to teach you faith, so that as you wandered in this wilderness for those 4 decades, I took care of all of your needs and never left you desolate. Humility, spirituality, and faith. But the nation, as it settled in the promised land, lost these 3 precious truths, and now they were in bondage again. And they were in bondage to the Babylonian king and its people. But out of those men and women in exile, Nebuchadnezzar made it his specific task to select the most able-bodied and the most able-minded young men from Judah, bring them into the palace to be able to reprogram them, give them a new kind of literature, a new kind of language, a new system of values, a new way to think. And he took the best of them, and the Bible narrates the story of at least 4 of them, Daniel and the 3 friends that he had that we have just briefly read about here as we look at Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. When they were put into the palace, notice what is it the first thing that the king tries to do? Soften them up, banqueting them, wining and dining them. And here Daniel drew his first line. He drew his line of resistance by training his appetite. Did you hear that? He drew his line of resistance by training his appetites. He said, I do not want the abundance of this food. I do not want all the enjoyment of the king's table. Give me a meager diet, and I will be happy and content with that. Gentlemen, I learn a very significant lesson here. You and I are responsible every day of our lives for training our hungers and training our passions. We are filled with hungers. We have physical hungers, emotional hungers, intellectual hungers, relational hungers, spiritual hungers. And it is imperative in a disciplined way that we train what we begin to enjoy and shun what we know can get us softened up and lose us to the service of the King of Kings. How did he do this? He learned to resist it early enough so that he would not get trapped into the lifestyle where he got used to these desires. About a year ago, my telephone rang at 11:30 at night. It was a medical doctor, and the doctor was crying on the phone. And he said, Ravi, I needed to talk to you alone. I have committed something very serious that I think could end up costing me my life itself. I said, what happened? He said, as you know, I'm an emergency surgeon. And I was doing emergency surgery this evening. And they brought in a young woman who was very far gone. He said she had been so brutally beaten by her husband. I had never seen a human body so broken up and so ravaged. Virtually every bone in that body had been broken. I saw this pitiful sight as the ambulance people brought her into the emergency room. I knew she was already too far gone. But I desperately wanted to help her. And so rather than even trying something simple and something superficial, I cut the side of her rib cage and put my hand into that rib cage in order to get a hold of her heart with a direct heart massage to see if I could get it going again. He said, but the longer I worked on it, I felt it had become just a dead piece of rubber and was not responding. And quite heartbroken himself, looking at the shattered body in front of him, he said, I walked away, so dejected, so saddened by what I'd seen. He said, and just then as I'd removed my surgical gloves and was washing my hand, I noticed a very thin paper cut on one of my fingers. It was nothing more than the size of a paper cut. So I started to wash it away. I had got that from forcing my hand on the side of the rib cage. He said, and then the nurse walked in and said, Doctor, I've got something to show you. I was going through the pockets of this woman, and I found these syringes, these dirty used needles, and all of her packets of drugs in there. And all of a sudden, it dawned on this doctor that he may well have plunged his hand into the ribcage of somebody who could now have put his life at risk, either for HIV or for hepatitis, because of that cut. And I looked at the guy, said to the doctor on the phone, I said, wait a minute, did you not say it is just the size of a paper cut, a very thin cut? He said, yes. And I said, you're telling me that a simple little cut like that, so small, can actually put you at risk for a disease such as hepatitis or HIV? He said, absolutely. He said, I have already been called in by the chief sir of the surgery to be able to go through some tests, and it'll be a few days before they will be absolutely sure. Gentlemen, if one little cut in a finger can put this physical body at risk, think of how often you and I put ourselves at risk spiritually when we do not draw the lines of our appetites and train them so that we don't come away with those paper cuts that could ultimately be more destructive than you had ever envisioned. We draw the line of resistance by the training of our appetite. Secondly, he drew his line of dependence. He depended not on his learning, not on his language, not on his philosophical training, not on his understanding of all of the cultural ethos with which he lived. Daniel came at a moment in his life where he had to learn where his true source of wisdom was going to be. You see, Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. And in that dream, he saw a gigantic statue which had a head of gold, a chest of silver. It had a belly and thighs of bronze, legs of iron, and feet that were mixed with iron and clay. And when he saw this statue in his dream, he saw a rock that had come from seemingly nowhere and had smashed this statue to smithereens. He awakened up and said, I need to understand what this dream is about. And he sent for all of the astrologers, all of the magicians, all of the sorcerers in the land, and said to them, I would like you to interpret this dream for me. And they were, of course, smart men. They said, King, why don't you tell us the dream, and then we will interpret it for you. Nebuchadnezzar was smarter than them. He said, if you have all this ability to interpret a dream, which is a supernatural ability, why don't you first tell me the dream that I had, and then interpret it? And the men, of course, could not tell him what dream he had had. He wasn't telling that to them. Finally, they came upon Daniel. And Daniel got on his knees before God. He said, God, I don't know what dream this man has had. Can you give that dream to me so I can stand in front of him and spare the lives of so many? And God revealed that dream to Daniel. And Daniel went on to tell Nebuchadnezzar that he had seen a statue, head of gold, chest of silver, belly and thighs of bronze, legs of iron, feet of iron and clay, and a rock cut out of no human hand, the kingdom of God itself would come and smash those successive kingdoms. You are the head of gold. You'd be succeeded by a weaker empire, weaker and weaker and weaker, till all of these empires would be destroyed. He said, King, that is the dream that was given to you, and this is the interpretation that God has given to me. The fascinating thing to me about Daniel is, with all of his learning, he knew exactly how limited his learning was, that he needed to lean on God's wisdom and not on his own philosophy and not on his own education. Gentlemen, when we entered this century, the 20th century, we were told that this was going to be the greatest century of knowledge and advance. We were told we were going to scale new heights. We were going to triumph over areas of understanding we never knew before. And yet now as we look at the tail end of this century, please listen to me. With all of our learning, with all of our knowledge, with all of our understanding, with all of our scientific progress, this has been the bloodiest century in all of history. All our education has not erased the hate within the human heart. We are separated by generations. We are separated by genders. We are separated by races. We are separated by ethnic pride. We are separated by political warfare. Education can give you knowledge. It is God who gives us wisdom upon that knowledge. And how much we need that wisdom today. I speak on university campuses regularly and have spoken in them across many, many parts of the world. I see the increase of knowledge, increase of understanding, and yet I see the emptiness and the loneliness and the fragmentation of human life. We've lost the wisdom to know how to live. I hesitate very much to give you this illustration, and so please don't misread it, but listen to me carefully. A few weeks ago, many of you may have read in your newspapers about a 17 or an 18-year-old girl from somewhere in New Jersey who was in the middle of her prom dance and excused herself. Nobody knew what she was up to. Went over into the restroom alone, gave birth to her baby, and no one knew that had happened. And now she is charged with taking that live-born baby and putting it into a plastic bag and in a garbage and suffocating it to death. It was a tragedy. The whole nation realizes it was a tragedy. What happened to this young life? My heart went out to her when I read it. She must be a very, very confused and a desperate young woman to be able to do what she did without the tinge of any feeling. And psychiatrists are trying to express to us what has happened to this generation that doesn't feel it's wrong anymore. But the tragedy of that story was exceeded by a leading newspaper that ran a lead article. And it said this, the reason this has happened and the reason a young girl like this did what she did is because of those who stand for the protection of the unborn. Did you hear that? It is those who are protecting the life of the baby and the fetus. It is they who are to blame, said the newspaper, driving such people to such choices. Now, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Is that right? If I think the life of a baby in its mother's womb is sacred and is a life that demands the protection of the mother and all of humanity, am I to blame when somebody chooses to obliterate it? Ah, but we've lost our ability to think rationally. The wisdom has gone. We have almost educated ourselves into imbecility. Gentlemen, gentlemen, listen to these words. Listen to these words that were written by one young person. In the 1950s, kids lost their innocence. They were liberated from their parents by well-paying jobs, stars, and lyrics and music that gave rise to a new term, the generation gap. In the 1960s, kids lost their authority. It was the decade of protest. Church, state, and parents were all called into question and found wanting. Their authority was rejected, yet nothing ever replaced it. In the 1970s, kids had lost their love. It was the decade of meism dominated by hyphenated words beginning with self, self-image, self-esteem, self-assertion. It has made for a lonely world out there. Kids have learned everything there is to know about sex, have forgotten everything there is to know about love, and few have the nerve to tell them there is a difference. In the 1980s, kids have lost their hope, stripped of innocence, authority, and love, and plagued by the horror of a nuclear nightmare, large and growing numbers of this generation have stopped believing in the future. In the 50s, they lost their innocence. 60s, they lost their authority. 70s, they lost their love. 80s, they lost their hope. And I would like to add that in the 90s, we have lost our wisdom, lost the ability to discern between what is good, what is bad, what is right, what is wrong. And where wisdom has gone, the tragedy of disbelieving in God, said G.K. Chesterton, is not that a person ends up believing in nothing. Alas, it is much worse. A person ends up believing in anything. Many, many years ago, there was a television program that stirred the imagination of the nations. I don't think they would show a television program like that now. Over 30 years ago, this was shown. It was a play within the play. In a barroom, a half-drunk intellect carried out the masquerade. He talked about a situation that had developed in the United Nations, where the world's leaders had decided they were going to press the buttons and the superpowers were going to declare war upon each other. And at 12 midnight Greenwich Mean Time, the buttons were going to be pressed. But in the meantime, one man came along and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, can we at least have the 4 hours before that midnight hour to see if there is a solution that can be found? Something that could keep us from destroying one another." And he brought a massive computer into the room and set it up. He said, "I would like every man, woman, and child who can come into this room and feed the information into the computer of what they know is best for humanity, what they know will guarantee our well-being, all the wisdom of the ages. Feed it into the computer. It will give us an answer of how to keep World War III from happening." Men came, women came, children came, sages came, philosophers came, lawyers came, poets came, tramps on the streets came, and they all gave their information into the computer. And there was no answer coming. At 1 minute before midnight, the lights began to flicker, and a piece of paper came out of the mouth of that computer, as it were. And the man lifted the piece of paper and says, "It tells me there is an answer. Here is what the answer is. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not covet." Centuries have gone by. The wisdom is still in here. Amen. Gentlemen, this is your wisdom, and this is mine. With all your learning, sir, with all your education, with all the power for wealth and the passion and hunger for pleasure and all else, let this be the greatest hunger of all. The psalmist has said, "Teach me to number my days, that I might incline my heart to wisdom." James says the wisdom from above is peaceable, pure, sincere, submissive, and full of mercy, and raises the harvest of righteousness. The writer to the book of Proverbs says, "It is the fear of the Lord that is the beginning of wisdom." Watch the life of Daniel. He drew his line of resistance, drew his line of dependence, and lastly, he drew his line of confidence. They tried to force him to choose between God and the king. And Daniel said, "I am choosing to follow God, no matter what happens. If you want to throw me into the lion's den, that is fine." Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said, "If you want to throw us into the fiery furnace, that's fine. Our God will deliver us. But even if he does not deliver us from this, we will not bend our knee to a false God." He knew his line of confidence. That's the kind of man you and I need to be. To draw the line of resistance, to draw the line of dependence, to draw the line of confidence. Those are the disciplines that mold you and me into the blueprint that God has for you and for me in our lives. What happened? What happened? Listen, the story is fascinating. Daniel drew his lines, and those lines were crossed. But do you know who crossed the lines? Three Babylonian kings. They crossed the lines and came over to Daniel's side. Nebuchadnezzar, Darius, and Cyrus, they saw the kind of life he lived and the lines that he drew, and they crossed over onto his side. Isn't it fascinating to know that when you draw the lines to be a man of God, people will watch your good works, watch your convictions, and be drawn to your heavenly Father? You know, something fascinating happened a few weeks ago. I think it was extraordinary. Within a week died two prominent women in this world. One was beautiful, charming, lovely, more photographed than any other in our time. Graced the page of so many magazines. I still remember at the midnight hour listening to the news that Princess Diana had died in that tragic car accident. My wife and our children stood around that television screen, and our hearts ached for that situation, for her family, for her children, and for the people who were near and dear to her. And the world mourned. It mourned particularly because they saw in her all that was beautiful on the outside, but all that was lost on the inside. 1 week later, a haggard, old, diminutive woman by the name of Teresa passed away too. And the world mourned, and yet the world celebrated. Leaders from all over the world came, not because of what she had lost, but because of what she had won, and what she had gained, and what she had shown. Hear me. I was on a television interview with CNN, and they were asking me the question, what made the impact of this life? I had the privilege of being with her on a couple of occasions and seeing the work she did. And the only thing she kept saying every time we met her was love Christ, was love Christ, was love Christ. Now listen to me. As her body lay in that church, and thousands and millions were watching that ceremony, did you notice, out of all of the leaders, one who stood there the longest by her corpse president of Albania. Albania is the most vociferously atheistic country in the world, yet he stood with his head bowed, recognizing a life that had been so magnificently lived. You know what? Mother Teresa came to Washington and finished the talk. The press reporter looked at President Clinton and said, "What do you think about her? What do you think?" She had said many things that the president did not agree with. "What do you think of her, Mr. President?" You know what he said? "It is very difficult to argue against a life so beautifully lived. It is very difficult to argue against a life so beautifully lived." When Jacob was running, having betrayed his brother, and they came years later when Jacob was going to meet up with his brother again, he wrestled with God in prayer, and he said, "God, I will not let you go unless you bless me." What did God say to him? God could have said many things. "Jacob, you've lived such a terrible life, you've lied, you've deceived, you've done all of this, and you want me to bless you?" Instead, God looked at Jacob and said, "Jacob," and he called him by name. He looked down and said, "What is your name? What is your name?" Why did God ask him that? Because years before, when Jacob knelt before his blind father Isaac to steal his older brother's blessing, his father couldn't see him. And he said, "Who are you?" And Jacob lied and he said, "My name is Esau." And the father said, "You don't sound like Esau." He said, "I am Esau." And he stole the blessing before his blind father, who did not know who he was. Now he was kneeling before an all-seeing God. And God's first question to him was, "What is your name?" He couldn't lie. I understand that this stadium is built with an opening so God can watch the Cowboys play. Let me tell you something, even if that were closed, God can still watch the Cowboys play. What is your name? Are you willing to see your heart today as God sees it? When Jacob said, "My name is Jacob," God said, "You've spoken well. I will now make a great nation out of you." Gentlemen, there's a nation without wisdom. There's a nation where the lines are drawn in a different place. Will you make a commitment this morning to draw your line of resistance, to draw your line of dependence, and to draw your line of confidence? And may God use you to bring many to cross the line, to put their hand into the hand of the living God. May God bless you. Will you please pray with me together now? Oh God, how beautiful the sight of thee must be, thy endless wisdom, boundless love and awesome purity, prostrate before thy throne to lie and gaze on thee. Precious Jesus.